The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So I'd like to begin by thanking you all for being here today, and especially those of you who came for the whole day. I think of this as one of the most significant offerings that IMC offers to the world. It's a chance to come and practice in this kind of in community in silence, so that we can really kind of negotiate and find our own way with the teachings, the practice, and the traffic. The goal of Buddhist practice is to become free of suffering, a freedom that is often described as being happy. People who have freed themselves from the suffering and the forces of suffering inside of them are said to be happy and peaceful. They also are people who are, I don't know if committed is the right word, but maybe devoted to the welfare of others, to be concerned for how others are and in some way or other. And it's a beautiful goal, and it's understood in Buddhism that there's a path to that goal. There's a journey to be taken. And that journey of practice has two primary components, two class categories kind of practices. One are the things that are cultivated, and the other is letting go, the things that we let go of. And both are needed. They both go hand in hand, that we want to cultivate, develop certain capacities and qualities we have, and we want to be able to let go. Let go of things that are causing us harm. Let go of things that we do that cause harm to others. To let go of the clinging or the grasping or the resistance or the fear or cravings that bind us, keep us caught up, keep us preoccupied. Because the final goal of liberation through non-clinging, is called liberation through non-clinging, there's a way in which the emphasis is often on letting go. And I think it's marvelous if we let go in the right way. There are people who let go inappropriately. They let go of everything. They let go of the wrong things. It's one thing to let go of your clinging to your bank account. It's the other thing is to let go of the bank account. It's one thing to let go of the clinging to your partner. It's another thing to let go of your partner. So you're not necessarily expected to let go of your bank account or your home or your friends, people like that. But the clinging to them is extra. Clinging to them is kind of the heart, closer to the heart of what Buddhist practice is about. But there are people misunderstanding about clinging, and so they think you're supposed to let go of everything. And so there's kind of a wholesale kind of rejection even of life, of this world that we live in. But we have to be more nuanced and careful about this non-clinging, the letting go. Some people who come to Buddhism find the teachings on letting go immediately resonate, immediately are freeing. And that, this is what I've been waiting to hear. And they're able to let go of all kinds of things, put down their baggage, put down their burden. And in doing that, feel relief. Other people hear the teachings on non-clinging and are mystified. How do you, they don't even know they cling, let alone that they're not supposed to cling or that how to let go. It just seems too opaque, it's too obscure, it's just inaccessible to do it. Or it can seem too big of a deal, or even too frightening, or inappropriate to do it. And the other half of Buddhist practice is what we cultivate, what we develop. So here it's not about letting go of something, but it's actually, in a sense, acquiring something or developing something, or if it's not there, kind of bringing it about so it can be there and cultivating it. And sometimes this gets emphasized, sometimes it doesn't get emphasized enough, this side of practice. Sometimes the challenge around the cultivating part is that some people are, I don't know, maybe if I say this word, I don't imply any of you, but some people are neurotic doers. And so it's all about doing, it's about being in control, it's about manipulating, fixing, getting things just all lined up just right, and or to feel like I'm responsible, I'm the one who has to do it, I have to get it right. If I don't do it, then I'm a failure, and no one wants to be a Buddhist failure. And so, you know, I have to kind of, you know, and then some people feel, well, the very fact that I have to do something and cultivating something, this is an offense to me because I'm already perfect. I'm already supposed to be wonderful, and I have, you know, I have self-esteem, and so I can't be told to do anything, and if I'm told to do anything, it means I'm not so great after all, right? And so some people get crushed under the weight of being said, you know, this, you might think about cultivating a little bit of something and developing certain qualities of you. So it can certainly be challenging. So both those teachings, letting go and cultivating, can have their downside or have their traps. But they also work very well together. And in a sense, together, they protect themselves. They support each other. And, you know, some things we should let go of, some things we should cultivate. We let go of the things which are harmful, that cause us suffering, and we cultivate those things which support us in the process of letting go. So part of this is looking at certain qualities within us that we want to strengthen, make bigger or stronger, bigger, more larger parts of our lives. And some people cannot let go until they first become strong, develop certain capacities. And then task is, before we can let go, is to cultivate and develop ourselves and strengthen ourselves. And sometimes it's kind of like the snake that as it grows bigger, then it sheds its skin. And so rather than that we have to let go of things, some things just fall off as we get stronger or bigger or develop ourselves. It's no longer needed. We kind of no longer feel, committed to it, interested in it, because now we know something better. We've gotten stronger or bigger or happier or something. And sometimes doesn't make sense to let go of things, because if we let go, we don't have anything to support us. There's no stability there, no strength there holding us up. It's maybe like, I don't know why this comes up as an example, maybe because of the weather today, earlier, is, you can let go of your umbrella, but if you do it while it's raining, you know, it's better to let go of it after it stops raining. And, and it's kind of silly to keep carrying your umbrella around for days and months, especially here in California summers, just in case it rains. You know, at some point you put it down, you leave it at home. But if it's raining, that's not the time to let go of it. Or if you are, if you have injured your foot and you need a cane or a crutch to walk on, if you let go of that while you still need it, you could actually hurt yourself even more. But you wait and you develop and strengthen your leg, let it heal, and at some point you can let go of it. So sometimes it only makes sense to let go when the conditions are right, when we've developed ourselves and become strong. Sometimes people let go too early. There are some things we can let go of, maybe, but it doesn't give us any, we're left with nothing to hold on to, no stability, no reference points to find our way. So, for example, sometimes it becomes pretty clear to people that they're clinging to some identity, some idea of who they are. They identify with their role, they identify with some ability they have, all kinds of things we identify with. And we've kind of built up a sense of self around this identity, around this idea of who we are. And with that, we figured out how to find our way in the world. We know how to negotiate the world, how to present ourselves to people, and how to make sure they, or not make sure, but hope that we can make them see us in a certain way, and we negotiate and find our way. And some people, but then if we feel that no longer serves us, this identity, so it's time for me to put it down. But if we put it down and we have nothing to replace it, sometimes people get lost. Like, who am I, and what am I supposed to do here, and who am I in relationship to everyone else? And it can be quite frightening for some people to see their usual identity drop away. But if they wait to let go of their attachment to self-identity to a time when there's a strong sense of inner confidence and other strengths that are there kind of holding us up, then we can let go of the identity and we're left with the strength. And so it's not, you know, it's like no big deal. Now I know that how to be in this world. I know I have the inner stability, the inner sense of safety. I have these kind of qualities that support me and help me go through the world. So these two sides, to cultivate and to let go of. And they don't have to be done separately. They don't have to be done independent of each other. They can work together quite nicely. That if we want to cultivate generosity, which is one of the prime kind of cardinal virtues to be developed in Buddhism, develop generosity, but you kind of have to let go of something to be generous. Because otherwise you're not really being generous. So you let go of, if you give money, you're letting go of your money. If you're giving your neighbor dinner because they're sick, you're letting go of the dinner and offering it to them. Maybe you had gone shopping and you got your favorite pasta or something and you were looking forward to it, but your neighbor's sick. And so you offer that to your neighbor because you don't, rather than keeping it for yourself. Simple act of giving up in the act of being generous. So some of these things can be cultivated together and maybe need to be cultivated together. They're not separate from each other. But some things maybe, you know, we have more sense that we're cultivating it independently. So, for example, one of the other things that we're encouraged to cultivate is a basic attitude of friendliness, or metta, or kindness, goodwill, as we go through our world. And some people have to let go of a lot to be able to have goodwill or friendliness. But some people, maybe there's not much to let go of, but it never occurred to them to be friendly. And, so they decide, let's try to develop this. Let's, you know, I go to work and let me try to say some kind words, friendly words, or be interested in the people, my colleagues, rather than just kind of go to my desk and shut out everybody else. Let me kind of try to see if I can make the other people at work just kind of improve their day, make them slightly happier by asking how they are or wishing them a good day or bring them pasta or something. And so to cultivate a capacity for loving kindness through loving kindness meditation or practice in daily life can become something that grows and develops as a strength. We don't have to just kind of be content with whatever capacity we already have for kindness and friendliness. It's something that can be strengthened, developed, and become a bigger part of us. As it becomes a stronger part of us, it becomes a support for us. It becomes a refuge for us. It becomes a guide for how to be in the world. It becomes an orientation. So that when we let go of our self-identity, we're left with a strong capacity for friendliness and kindness and maybe an inclination to do it. And rather than being lost what to do when there's no self-identity, we're kind, we're friendly. That can't be that bad. So we're left with something. We're left with something that's helpful. So one of the things that's nice about developing inner strengths, developing these inner qualities, is that we start feeling like we're bigger and stronger. And so we go through the world and we have a ballast. We have stability. We have a capacity. We're not pushed around so easily. So the analogy that I like is that if there's a little ant and a huge, fly lands on the ant, it's kind of a big deal for the ant because, it's... But if the same fly should land on the back of an elephant, it's not a big deal for the elephant. It's probably a zero deal for the elephant. And sometimes we haven't developed these inner capacities that we have, if they're underdeveloped, then we're quite fragile and things happen to us and we feel kind of weak and they push us around or overwhelm us or frighten us or they just kind of feel like a big deal to handle. And so we're kind of a little bit more like the ant. But if we develop these inner qualities and capacities, then we become a little bit more like the elephant. And so as the ant, there's things that you might be negotiating and try to fix and solve and deal with that seem so important. But when you're an elephant, you don't have to deal with it anymore. it's just like not an issue anymore. I don't have to go to psychotherapy anymore for the problem because it's just a little, it's a little, you swish your tail and, it's not a big deal. I'm not putting down psychotherapy at all, and I'm not suggesting that it's not useful. It's very useful, but there are certain, issues that maybe don't have to be addressed by all kinds of things, even by meditation. Maybe you don't need to meditate for certain problems if you've gotten strong and big and have the confidence, and then you swish your meditation tail, and there it goes. Who cares about that? And I've seen that among people who practice for a long time, that they still have a few foibles. They feel his or oddities about how they are. But what's quite impressive is how they seem to be relaxed around it. They're not kind of burdened by it or troubled by it or pushed around by it. They have these things and they seem to be relatively free, but it's still there, where they don't feel like they have to go and kind of, get rid of it or solve it or analyze it or fix it because they're bigger. So one example for me in my life where I got bigger was the year I spent in the kitchen in the Buddhist monastery. I was assigned to work in the kitchen for a year. And the first day I came into the kitchen to work there, the kitchen felt really big. I didn't have any cooking skills, and so I was certainly intimidated and unsure of myself. And the kitchen, like, wow, this is like, I'm in trouble here. What am I going to do here? So I spent a year in the kitchen, learned to do all the things you do in the kitchen, but I became the kitchen manager. Not only did I know the job well enough, I knew how to supervise other people. I knew all the ins and outs of the kitchen. And then a year later, it was my last day to work in the kitchen. And so I knew it was my last day, and I remembered how I felt the first day. And I looked around the kitchen, and that monastery kitchen now felt small. So what had changed over the course of the year? The kitchen hadn't changed size. Somehow I had changed, and I had developed confidence in my ability to be there. And I had developed a certain kind of mastery of being in the kitchen. And that confidence and mastery, I could find my way around easily and spin around. I wasn't intimidated by what's there. And so in that lack of intimidation, it wasn't so overwhelming, and it felt like it just was a manageable room to walk around in and deal with. So one of the things to cultivate that's really helpful in life is confidence. And because many times the lack of confidence makes us a little bit more like an ant. Things are just, we're kind of buffeted by things. So how do we cultivate confidence? And I'd like to suggest maybe two ways. One way is to recognize the things you're already confident that you have about, that you haven't really acknowledged. and give yourself credit for it. So, you know, chances are that if you've managed to get to the age of 21, there's all kinds of things that you've managed to, you're successfully managed to do. You can walk. You can feed yourself. You can go to the bathroom by yourself and don't have to ask the parent to do it for you, to help you out. I mean, this is like significant things, I tell you. I'm a parent, so when that transition, when that happens, it's like a big deal. So, but you know, the kids just take it, they don't think about it anymore. But maybe you went through school, you managed to get through school, maybe you managed to learn how to cook and make your own meals. Maybe you managed to find yourself a job. Maybe you survived some job interviews and didn't crush you. Or maybe you even got a job offer. I don't know. There's all kinds of things that we learn. Maybe you started to learn, you know, a skill. Maybe play a musical instrument. Or maybe you decided you wanted to start, hiking or some kind of exercise. And that at first you felt small. You felt like it. You couldn't do it. But over the days and weeks and months and years that you did it, what seemed intimidating and difficult that you couldn't do when you started your exercise becomes rather relatively easy. You can walk, you know, rather than being exhausted after 1 mile and going for hikes in the mountains here. You can, after a while, you have confidence. So I can walk 5 miles. And some of these hills over there up in these local mountains can be steep. And it's like, wow, I don't know if I can do that. But after you do it for a while, you have some confidence you can do the. So what I'm trying to convey here is kind of very ordinary, simple things that it might not occur to people to recognize that they have developed confidence. We're so focused sometimes on the important things in life, whatever that is. And sometimes what we think is important, maybe, you know, the big things or something. Sometimes we have a generalized, vague, unspecified, without any evidence, idea that we can't do it. We're not up to task. You know, it never occurred to, you know, that's just a general principle that's, like, you know, some people might live under. It doesn't really matter what, they don't have any clear idea of what it is they can't do. That's just who they are. But in fact, if they pay attention, they find there's lots of things that they can do. And that maybe they couldn't used to do it. So one way to develop confidence is to take credit for the things you can do. To recognize, oh, I'm confident in this. I can do this. I can do this. I know someone who, as a 28-year-old adult, had no confidence in driving and was intimidated by the very idea of going to a gas station to put gas in the car. It was like an overwhelming idea. After some years of driving, this person that I know doesn't think twice about it, has forgotten the lack of confidence. So one way is to recognize what you can do and give yourself credit for it. And then you start feeling, oh yeah, feel a certain little bit upright, little bit of strength, be buoyed by it. The second way to develop confidence is by doing things. It doesn't work so well just sit at home. I'm supposed to be confident. I better become confident. What do I have to think? What kind of thoughts do I have to do? What do I have to realize? What do I have to kind of penetrate and understand about myself? What's the deep, dark secret here that I have to sit and analyze and understand? I better journal and try to figure what else. So that might be useful sometimes, but the way to develop confidence is to do things to the point where you feel like now I can do it. I have confidence I can do it. To learn something. And so, are there things that you learn and develop in your life that that you know, you take the steps, you engage, and develop some confidence. So in terms of meditation practice, you can start slowly, start developing develop confidence in your capacity to meditate. I've known people who were overwhelmed and frightened. They thought it was impossible. It can't be done to meditate for 5 minutes. And I've had people who just like were stir crazy after 5 minutes of meditation. Like, wow, this is like the most difficult thing. Why would anybody do this? And then I've known them that over time, they could sit for 45 minutes and not a single thought about, I can't do this, like this is too much. And then I've known people then who've started off with those 5 minute, terror, and then they go off on retreat. And not only do they do 45 minutes, they do 45 minutes 7-8 times through the day. And then they find themselves sitting for an hour and a half without moving. And just like, oh, this is nice. So slowly, slowly, people develop confidence in their ability to sit and be with themselves, to be quiet. It doesn't occur to people, some people, to take any, I don't know if credit is the right word, but to appreciate the growing confidence that's occurring. Maybe they don't have the custom of thinking in terms of confidence. They don't have the... and they have all kinds of more important things to be neurotic about. There's more important things to be thinking about than this silly little confidence thing. You know, that doesn't count. So to do things and to do it in small steps. It isn't that confidence, you have to do like the big challenging thing. It isn't that you climb up Mount Whitney tomorrow, 14,000 feet, is that what it is? Tomorrow, if you want to learn how to go hiking in the mountains, maybe you want to spend a couple of years slowly, developing your capacity to hike and to hike in mountains, and slowly you develop the ability to go up the highest mountain in California. So, but it does require doing. And this is where sometimes the language of letting go, teachers like me will talk about how we have to learn to be and not do. That doing somehow is, part of the neurosis of our culture, doing, 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 and we have to learn how to be. Some people actually don't need to learn how to be. They need to learn to do more so they can develop the confidence in themselves and to find themselves. I saw this a lot in the monasteries where I was in, like the Zen monasteries here in California, that a good number of people who came there, when you come there, you don't sit and meditate all the time at a Zen monastery. You're given a job. And, sometimes you get a new job every 3-4 months. And so, suddenly you're thrown into the kitchen, you don't know how to cook. You're made the baker, you don't know how to bake. You're made the plumber, and you don't know how to plumb. It's all these things that, suddenly you have a new career, and no one's trained you, and you have to figure it out. And you have to do your job, whatever it might be. And so in Zen training, a lot of the training happens not in the meditation, but in the jobs that you're given, and then learning how to do it. And the process of doing that, I've seen a lot of people develop confidence in themselves, a certain inner strength. They feel like now they can negotiate the world, they know how to take care of things, they can do things, and it kind of what they've learned to do in these different jobs in the monastery translate to a certain confidence that I can figure things out, I can do things and I can take care of things. And that self-confidence counts for a lot. In fact, sometimes a few people I've seen at the Zen monastery, that's what they didn't know that's what they were there for. But once they had developed a certain kind of self-mastery and confidence about being in the world and taking care of themselves, they were ready to leave. They had enough, that they'd gotten what they needed, and then they can go back into their life and manage just fine with their life. So some confidence comes from doing. And the emphasis on meditation and on letting go sometimes shortchanges people from the message of cultivation, of developing ourselves. And a lot of the cultivations are not just in meditation, but in our daily life. And there are, in that this Theravadan tradition of ours, 10 qualities that are particularly emphasized as being useful to develop. In fact, in Burma, when someone is on retreat and meditating a lot, and if they end up having some challenges and make their meditation difficult, one of the common responses of the teachers is that one or more of these 10 qualities are not strong enough. In order to make more progress in meditation, they need to strengthen one of these qualities or some of these qualities, these personal faculties. So I'll tell you these, what they are. So the first is generosity, to develop a capacity to be generous, to have not just a capacity to give, but generosity is a state or a quality. It's not an emotion, I guess, but it's an inner faculty that we have, and that faculty can become strong. So cultivate generosity. Cultivate virtue or ethical integrity. Become more sensitive to that, to develop that as a strength that we carry with us into the world and have confidence in that. And the Buddha said, actually, you get more than just confidence from being ethical. There's a certain kind of bliss you can get when you know and are clear that you're living an ethical life. It's called the bliss of blamelessness. You know that no one can blame you for anything. And that bliss of blamelessness, even if you did something, you know, yesterday that you don't feel you can be blamed for, then maybe at least for today, for this day, you can have the bliss of blamelessness. You stayed out of trouble sitting here today. So there's a certain kind of joy. So generosity, virtue, then it's renunciation, which is a frightening word for some people who speak English. But the word in Pali, in the Buddhist language, has different connotation than maybe the connotations of renunciation. The root of the word, nikamma, means to go out. And so rather than one of deprivation, that people often associate with renunciation, the word nikamma means more like you're going out into the open air from being cooped up. So it's like it's almost feeling like you gain something in the renunciation than you lose something. In the English, I think we often focus on what's lost. But some capacity to begin letting go. And it might be letting go or renouncing small things that just make it a little bit easier for us to kind of live our life and find our way. So it might be, small thing that I did was that when I had little kids who had to go to kindergarten and stuff, it was like, boy, oh boy. Living in the monastery was easier. Boy, it was like, I would sometimes be exhausted by the time I got the kids in the car to drive them to school. You know, it's like, phew, that was an ordeal. You know, all these things and the timing of it. But one of the things before I had kids that I like to do is I like to read the newspaper with breakfast. That was like kind of comforting, nice thing to do for me. So I wasn't so eager to let go of this ritual of mine. And so it got time for these kids to go to, you know, like they were 4, 5, 6, 7 years old. Somewhere in there, I had 2 of them. And at some point, I kind of, I think something has to change here in the morning routine. I think that I can't let go of making breakfast for them. I can't let go of getting them dressed. I can't let go of all kinds of things. There's only one thing I can let go of. So that I have more time and can do things in a more paced way, so I'm not out of breath by the time I get to the car. I can let go of reading the newspaper. So I did. And then actually it got a lot better. It turned out that those 10 minutes I tried to read the newspaper were all I needed to do everything else in a more useful way. So the third thing to cultivate is renunciation, letting go of some kind. The fourth is wisdom. It's easier to have wisdom if you know how to let go. And wisdom helps you let go more appropriately. And then there's developing effort or energy. I think of it as, strength, effort, energy. This has to do with how we engage in the things that we do. And so to be able to engage whatever we do with a wholeheartedness, and to cultivate the capacity to do it wholeheartedly. This is one of the things I also learned through my Zen training, was when you do something, just really do it. And it actually turns out it's a lot easier to do it if you really do it. When I first started in the kitchen, I didn't actually want to be in the kitchen, because I didn't think that was real Zen practice. And so I was kind of there half-heartedly. And I got to see how that didn't work. And so the training was to do it wholeheartedly. And I learned that if I did it wholeheartedly, it was just the whole thing was a lot easier. I'd leave the kitchen not so exhausted. Turned out doing it half-heartedly was exhausting. Because there was kind of a resistance. But somehow giving myself over to it fully didn't mean I had to work hard or, you know, with physical strength. But it meant that when I'm doing this, this is what I'm doing. So cultivating capacity for engagement. And then truthfulness. Cultivate the capacity to be truthful, both in your speech and how you speak to yourself, but also to be truthful, meaning that how you live your life is true. That there's a correlation or a harmony between what you believe and how you live, between how you want to live and how actually you live. So there's a variety of things to cultivate truthfulness, to be a true person. And then resolve, to cultivate a capacity for resolve or determination, to be able to, when you decide to do something, to follow through. And this is a beautiful capacity. I'm going to do this. And I remember many years ago learning that I had to do that. It was helpful to do it. The way to cultivate it was when I went through my apartment to go from one part of the side of the apartment to the other side to put the clothes from the washer into the dryer to make the resolve that I was just going to go do that. Because there were so many things in my apartment to stop me along the way. Oh, look at that. Or maybe I should read that article. Or maybe I should, you know. And sometimes I kept getting distracted by just the things in my apartment. And so it was innocent enough, but eventually I got the clothes dry. but it was interesting to do the practice of resolve. When I decide to do something simple like go do this, that's what I'm going to do until, you know, unless the house is burning down. This is what I'm doing. Or if I'm cooking a meal, I'm just going to cook, or doing the dishes, just do the dishes. And is a kind of resolve to be determined, to follow through on what we're doing. That's a strength, the strength of follow through, of persistence, of resolve. And to make a decision and stand by it. And then the ninth one, these 10 qualities, is loving kindness. To develop our goodwill, our friendliness. And the final one is equanimity, to develop our capacity to be even-minded, to be have a mind which doesn't get easily agitated by the vicissitudes of life, to develop a capacity to be present and not be kind of stirred up or reactive to what's happening, but to somehow keep the mind and the heart open, receptive, soft, balanced, at ease with what's going on. And we all have that capacity to some degree, and you probably have developed equanimity in some areas of your life that you didn't have 20 years ago or 30 years ago. Most of us, you just think back at what it was like when you were 14. Mm-hmm. You know, and things are probably much more equanimous, or if you probably don't remember, but your parents remember, maybe. And I can remember when my sons were not equanimous. They were 4 or 5 years old, and boy, they needed to be equanimous for me. And but you know, so we develop some capacity as we get older. But to so it's something we have a capacity to do, but to cultivate and strengthen it. So it's a long list. Some people will choose one of these. They're called the paramis. Sometimes translated to English as the perfections. Another translation is the ultimates, that the things which are ultimately good to cultivate. And so so sometimes in order to support the practice of letting go and to do the deepest letting go that the practice is about, before we can let go, we need to develop these strengths. Develop some of these qualities. And as these qualities become stronger and stronger, then they're there to support the letting go. It's like, then we can let go of the crutches and we can walk without any crutches anymore. Clinging, grasping, attachments are all kind of like crutches that are kind of we're trying to find our way with. And we, you know, at some point we don't need them and it's easier to let go. So oftentimes the things we cultivate in Buddhism are things we do in our daily life practice. That's where we can develop certain things. And we can start in small steps, and as we do them, we also develop the confidence, and that confidence becomes very important. Some of this also is developed in meditation. So we cultivate concentration, we cultivate strength of mindfulness, we cultivate patience, all kinds of things that we cultivate as we meditate. And some of those things are developed unintentionally, even kind of we don't even notice them growing in us. But some focus on cultivation, some focus on developing ourselves is an important part of practice. How to do it wisely, so that we don't get tied up or trip over ourselves as part of the art. Some letting go is part of the practice, but how to let go wisely so that we don't trip over ourselves is part of the art. How to bring letting go and cultivation together is part of the art. And so slowly over time, you'll develop confidence in your ability to cultivate, develop yourself, confidence in your ability to let go. Slowly over time you cultivate and develop your capacity to let go. And at the right moment you'll learn to let go of everything you've developed. So enjoy it. Just enjoy your practice, enjoy yourself. So thank you very much for today. It's the custom here at IMC